It's the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. It's been less than a week since President Joe Biden announced another extension for the pause on student loan payments, as well as his decision that he would cancel up to $20,000 in federal student loan debt, potentially affecting as many as 43 million borrowers. The reaction, both from advocates and critics, has been intense as policymakers weigh the costs and benefits of such a move. Join in this discussion with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Godlewski is the Wisconsin State Treasurer. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Shereen. It's great to be here.
What is your reaction to President Joe Biden's student debt plan? Were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised because we've been following what President Biden has been talking about, and he has been an advocate of giving working people a little bit of relief. And we know right now in the state of Wisconsin, over 700,000 Wisconsinites are struggling. And this is at a debt of over $23 billion. And so this kind of first step in providing relief for those folks at either $10,000 or $20,000, I think is a step. And look, we've got a lot more to do when it comes to whether it's college affordability or investing in the trades. But I do think that this is something, and in my conversations with Wisconsinites, they've been grateful to getting that breathing room.
What are some of the potential strengths or weaknesses of this plan as you see it?
Well, I think that there are a few benefits. Like, look, one of the pieces of this executive order is working on making payments more manageable. And so allowing folks that are struggling with student debt to pay 5% of their discretionary spending when before it was 10. But I think some of the other pieces that are not often talked about is, look, like something that we know that has been a problem even right here in Wisconsin is for-profit colleges. And what President Biden now is investing in is an enforcement unit that's going to provide oversight and kind of further strengthen accreditators who are really ripping students off and ripping off families and creating a watch list of schools or institutes or programs that have high debt and poor outcomes. And we know in Wisconsin, back when Governor Walker, he got rid of one of our oversights for for-profit colleges, and ITT Technology, which was a for-profit college, literally racked up millions of dollars of debt. They then claimed bankruptcy, and Wisconsin taxpayers had to potentially pay for that. And so I think that this is something that is a benefit of this executive order in providing transparency and accountability with for-profit schools. I think the other big piece is that we are so grateful to our firefighters and police officers and teachers, and the student debt forgiveness program for public service individuals has been literally left on the wayside. You know, 99% of applicants that have applied for public service loan forgiveness have been denied. And so under this executive order, it is reopening up that process. So 99% of people who apply are not going to be denied. They should be rewarded for the public service that they are providing for their communities.
We're talking about President Joe Biden's new student debt relief plan. Our guest is Wisconsin's state treasurer, Sarah Godlewski. How do you see this federal student debt relief affecting the state economy? What impact do you think that will have?
Well, let's look at the number at the end of the day. We know that our student debt number here in our state is $23 billion. And on average, we're seeing students are carrying about $32,000 in debt. And that has an impact in their ability to, let's say, buy a home. And we know home ownership is critical to strengthening communities. It's preventing individuals from actually participating in the economy, whether it's buying cars or starting even a family. I know when I was a part of the student debt task force with the governor, one of the things that we did was we did a listening tour around the state, and folks were coming and saying, look, like, I would like to start a family, but I'm really worried about how I can afford that when my job that I that I have currently between rent and student loans and my car loan. Like, I just can't stay ahead of all of it. And we're seeing that even right here in Wisconsin, we're below the national average when it comes to first-time homeowners or young homeowners. And so to me, we are seeing, I think, this lack of engagement in the economy because folks are just continuing to pay off this debt at a time when we know that college affordability today was very different than what it was when my parents went to college. You know, when my parents went to college, tuition per year was under $1,000. They could pay for that just by working a summer job. Today, it is over $10,000, and you can't make that up in just a summer job like you could. Mm-hmm. With the previous generation. And so I think that this is all having significant impact, mm-hmm. and we're going to see re-engagement, I think, in an important way.
Well, let's go to the phone. We have Steve from Sun Prairie with us. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, I guess I want to take issue with one comment your guest had about for-profit colleges. The vast majority of the debt that is incurred by students are from public colleges, and that we need to look at if there's a misrepresentation in terms of what the value is for the degree that you're going to get. We need to look at public colleges that are offering degrees that have no ability to pay those debts off, such as gender studies and things like that. We need to look at cutting costs from public mm-hmm. colleges that have raised significantly more than inflation over the past 20 years.
Steve, thank you. And Sarah, that really ties into what you were just talking about, how the cost of tuition has gone up so much. What do you think about what Steve said?
No, I completely agree with Steve. I think what I was sharing with listeners is that there's a lot more involved in the governor's executive order than just the $10,000 that folks are talking about. But I think in addition to Steve's comment, you know, one of the other pieces we've got to look at that I mentioned at the top of the hour was tech schools and trade schools. We know there's a lot of opportunity for not just good paying jobs, but there's no debt often involved. And these are incredibly affordable opportunities and people can start getting credits in high school. And so I think we really need to build on these partnerships and really grow these opportunities.
One of the big questions about this plan is how it should be paid for. University of Pennsylvania researchers say this plan would cost between $300 and $980 billion over 10 years. How do you see the federal government paying for this plan?
I mean, the one thing that President Biden has talked about is that through his work, he has worked diligently to actually cut the debt. I mean, we saw with the Inflation Reduction Act, we're actually cutting the debt by whether it's raising the corporate tax rate to finally providing enforcement with the IRS to make sure folks pay their fair share. And so I think continuing to do this type of work that the president has advocated for is going to help put these pieces together.
We have State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski with us. This is the State Capitol Report. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue our discussion on federal student loan forgiveness and other issues in state politics. Join in on what matters to you and which issues you think elected officials should focus on right now. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Godlewski is the Wisconsin State Treasurer. She stays with us. I'm curious about what your feelings are about this plan, the debt forgiveness plan, when I've heard some people say this is going to put pressure on lawmakers to reduce student debt further. Do you see that happening, or is this going to be it really?
I will say from my perspective, I think that this is it because we know that something that's incredibly important in this conversation is we have to get to the systemic root of what's causing this debt. You know, we just can't keep putting Band-Aids on the problem. And so there's, I think, two next steps with that. I think one is college affordability, You know, we know that when our public university started, over 70% of it was actually paid for by the state, and less than 30% were paid for through tuition. Now today, that's the exact opposite. Tuition is a primary revenue stream that funds our public institutions, and students and their families carry that burden. And so we've got to think that through. You know, the second piece is that we have not put enough emphasis on our tech schools and our trade schools. You know, we know that partnering with our high schools, students could start actually getting their, whether it's their electrician certificate, or they could become a tradesman. And by the time that they graduate from high school, they could actually start going into the field and have this important skill that pays good benefits, pays a good livable wage. But that often has not been emphasized in our high schools, I think, in the way that we've really got to think through in promoting these high need jobs. You know, we need plumbers, we need electricians, we need folks in the child care industry. And so I think this is also a really big opportunity that we have to move forward on.
On the phone, we have Kurt from Stevens Point with a question for you. Hi, Kurt. Thanks for calling.
My son just graduated last May, and he only has $5,000 in debt. But we were told over the weekend by a couple people that in order to be eligible, you have to have already made 60 payments towards your debt. Is there any truth to that?
What's the answer to that, Sarah?
You know, Kurt, I do not believe that is true, but there has been a navigation hotline that has been set up for folks in the state through the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. That number, I can give it to you, is 1-833-589-0750. And they have been fielding calls because we know, too, a lot of this recent legislation has been getting into a lot of the fine details. I've even been hearing, you know, do people get refunds, for example, and what state taxes? And so I think there's a lot of still fine print, but this 1-800 number should be very helpful in helping you navigate that.
Thank you for providing that number. We also have Laura from Middleton on the line as well. She has another question as well, and maybe that phone number can help her as well. Hi, Laura. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So, yeah, I'm just – this loan forgiveness does not apply to those of us who, for financial reasons, we consolidated our student loans to kind of make the payments more affordable. And so now I have, you know, my debt, which I totally intended to pay off and want to. But so I consolidated it, but now it is not eligible for this loan forgiveness. And it's also because it's considered private now, but also it's not dischargeable in bankruptcy because it's a student loan. So, and again, this is on top of a system that didn't consider me financially independent until I was 24, mm-hmm. Never mind that I was independent from the time I was 19.
Thank you, Laura. Sarah, can you give out that number again so that Laura can have that number?
And also, love
to hear your thoughts on what she had to say.
Well, first of all, Laura, I want to say I hear you, and I was actually in a very similar situation myself. I tried to get ahead of my student debt, and I consolidated all of it. And at that time, it was all under a private institution. And so it is incredibly frustrating that you're trying to do the right thing. But look, I think that there are kind of two opportunities. I think one is there is that navigation hotline that might be able to help answer some questions, but there's also a new tool that the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt recently released. And it's a one-stop shop where you can share your student debt information and they can pull in potential different resources available, whether that's grants or refinancing opportunities to make things potentially easier. And that website is wistrong.bysavi.com. That's Y Strong, so W-I-Strong, S-T-R-O-N-G dot B-Y-S-A-V-I dot com. And that's that one-stop shop tool that could be helpful in your situation. But I know that you are not alone when it comes to trying to do the right thing and consolidating.
Thanks for answering that. I appreciate that. Our guest is Wisconsin State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski. I want to ask you about some things that you hope to accomplish this year yet, but we have one more caller on this issue, and it's Bill from Ashland. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm sorry. I might lose you real quick. My first question or point is that your guest dodged the question, just like everybody else who's in favor of this bill, about who's going to pay for it, where's the money coming from. It's not coming from any of the policies that Joe Biden set in place. The second thing is the fact that we're pushing college so heavily in the first place. There is a huge shortage of truck drivers, of service workers. There's more jobs out there you can shake a stick at. And they pay much better than a lot of these entry-level jobs that most college kids, when they graduate, don't even get placed into a job that has anything to do with a degree. So if you could address both of those, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Sarah, what about the payment issue? Who is paying for this?
Well, I think just to get back to two of his questions, I think the first thing is, Joe, as I have mentioned, I couldn't agree more with you that we need to do everything we can to push the trades and partner with high schools so kids know about all of their opportunities and they're not taking on this ridiculous student debt. They can, whether it's drive truck or be a plumber or be a part of the childcare system. These are all high needed jobs that we've got to do better about advocating, promoting, and giving kids in our high schools an opportunity to start getting those credentials now. I think the second piece goes to, one of the things that the president has talked about, and I'm using the Inflation Reduction Act as the example, is whether it is increasing the corporation tax rate to what we are looking at when it comes to enforcement with the IRS. But there are opportunities that he has been looking at paying for this.
Thank you for addressing that. I appreciate that. You ran for U.S. Senate this year instead of running for re-election as state treasurer, and you ended your campaign before the primary election. I know you endorsed Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. What do you hope to accomplish before you leave office this year?
Well, Shereen, I will tell you, when I got into my office, it was we really worked on doing a total transformation. You know, when my first day, I will never forget, there were wires that were hanging down from the ceiling. My Wi-Fi was turned off in my office, and I was given a pay-as-you-go flip phone as a way to communicate with constituents. And for me, it has always been about what we can do to make life more affordable and to best serve our communities. And so I've really focused on a few things. One is transparency and accountability with our tax system. We started what I hope to be a new tradition in the office called the Taxpayer Report, which talks about where our tax dollars are going to and what we're benefiting from, because you shouldn't have to have an accounting degree to do that. The second thing that we've really been working on is economic security for Wisconsinites. I started a home ownership task force, and out of that task force, we created a program called Take Root Wisconsin, which is helping Wisconsinites buy, fix, and stay in their homes. And we have recently also worked in partnership with the governor's office to launch the Help for Homeownership program, which is helping folks who have been behind in whether it is their mortgage payments, utility payments, or even property taxes. And then the third piece is working through on win-win investments. So I chair a $1.4 billion trust fund. And under my leadership, we have provided the largest distributions to our public schools so they can buy hotspots e-learning books. And that's important because if we're not there to support our public schools, it would be taxpayers that would be making up for that deficit. And so continuing that smart investment strategy, and through these investment strategies, we've been able to even finance projects in local communities across the state. You know, since my tenure, we have invested in over 200 communities. And these are projects like, you know, bridge repairs or flood recovery, or even construction for public safety buildings. And so I think these win-win investments are really critical for the future of our state, and something that I hope my predecessor continues.
Sarah, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Godlewski is the Wisconsin State Treasurer. Ahead on the State Capitol Report, a state politics reporter shares insight on former State Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's 2020 election review and his influence over the past 13 months. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Former State Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman spent more than a year investigating allegations of voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election. Now that role has ended, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss had sharp words for Gableman when speaking to reporters earlier this month.
Mike Gableman is an embarrassment to the state.
Voss went on to say that Gableman isn't worth the time to talk about. Join in this discussion on the investigation, what came out of the probe, and what's next for Gableman now that the Office of Special Counsel is disbanded. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
What has come out of the probe that was announced more than a year ago?
Well, there's been quite a few lawsuits and a whole lot of, I guess you could call it debate. Some people might call it fighting in the Capitol over what to do with this probe that has lasted more than a year and it's cost taxpayers more than $1 million. Democrats from the start have said it wasn't necessary. It was launched to investigate the results of the 2020 election that have been confirmed by judges and nonpartisan state audits and even recounts paid for by former President Trump, who has disputed the results, and the Republican Assembly Speaker who authorized the probe and hired former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman said until very recently, as we just heard, that it was needed to address questions that Republicans still had about the outcome. But really the review that former Justice Gableman oversaw did not uncover really anything new. A lot of the things in the reports that he submitted to the legislature were findings or data that others had put together. There, in the last report, there was a section on nursing home voting turnout that myself and a reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal looked into and found that it didn't add up. It didn't look like what he was reporting in that report was accurate. So, but it has been used by former President Trump and his supporters to promote election conspiracies. And so there's a very real mistrust of the election system that has probably grown because of the reports that former Justice Gableman put out there that have promoted conspiracy theories. And that is something that when you talk to election clerks, they're very concerned about. So even if the review didn't really find anything, the distrust that it promoted is something that they're dealing with in a real way.
The review was initially supposed to be conducted by retired police detectives and focused on mm-hmm. voting machines. More than half of the original $676,000 budget was set aside for that analysis. What happened to that? Did that take place?
No, it did not. You're right. In the beginning weeks, I would say, former police officers, former detectives were supposed to be handling this review, and former Justice Gableman was supposed to be acting as sort of a coordinator, I would say. And then that just didn't happen, and we didn't get a lot of details as to why, but it just didn't go through. And then, you know, the review was supposed to be wrapped up by the end of 2021. And because the goal of the whole review initially was to get lawmakers some legislative proposals that they could pass in their legislative session ahead of the election. That never happened. The review like was delayed, and then the recommendations that he did put out were released, I think, a week or two after lawmakers went home for the year. So the initial goal, the review, was not met.
So you talk about the initial goal. How did the goals then change over the course of the like 13 months that that this probe went on?
Yeah, I mean, it was, that was the point of it when the Assembly Speaker launched it, and you know, it kind of changed into a vague purpose, you know, after not meeting that goal. And it seemed like it was more about, you know, former Justice Gableman, you know, just promoting these conspiracy theories. He didn't have a lot of work to show. He was issuing subpoenas to local officials to compel their testimony behind closed doors. And that created a whole, you know, legal battle that Republicans blame for the delay. But the Democrats and the Democratic local officials that were asked to testify say that they would be happy to testify about the election. They just didn't want to do it in private. But even so, that, you know, that whole debate, you know, pushed most of the probe after the end of 2021 into the courts.
Molly, my biggest question when I think about this now that the Office of Special Counsel is disbanded, is that the end? Is our investigations into the 2020 election over?
Well, I you know, at the official legislative level, they appear to be over. But there are, as you know, there are a lot of Republicans and conservative groups that still have questions about the election. And even, you know, the candidates running for governor, the candidate running for governor has questioned the outcome of the 2020 election. And so the issues that the Gableman probe were looking at and raising, you know, those are still very much alive. So while there might not be a, you know, an actual review going on at the legislative level, these, you know, claims of widespread voting fraud, which there has been no evidence to support that I've seen, you know, I want to make sure I say that there's no evidence to support that those claims that there was somehow mass manipulation of the 2020 election result and it should have gone a different way in Wisconsin. I have not seen any evidence to support that yet, but, you know, that those questions are still being talked about, and candidates running for very important offices in Wisconsin have embraced those claims. So in that way, you know, the goal of the review is still going on.
So nothing official is what I'm hearing, but
yes.
But the idea is still there.
Right.
We're talking about the end of the Office of Special Counsel investigating 2020 election fraud. Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, you recently reported that Michael Gableman has a new job at conservative law firm, the Thomas More Society. Why is this significant?
Well, right after he was fired by Speaker Voss, there was no announcement, but I did see at a, I watched a video of an appearance that former Justice Gableman made at an election conspiracy theory focused conference in Missouri, hosted by MyPillow executive Mike Lindell. And he was introduced as being senior counsel at the Thomas More Society. So that's interesting because, you know, Gableman was leasing some of his office space that was being paid for by taxpayers for this election review to the Thomas More Society. So that raises some questions about, you know, when did he start working for them? And, you know, what was really the arrangement there? The Speaker's office hasn't referred questions to the Thomas More Society, and the Thomas More Society hasn't answered those questions.
The Office of Special Counsel probe into the 2020 election cost $1 million. So what did taxpayer dollars pay for? Where did that money go?
So the taxpayer money paid for an office in Brookfield. It paid for office equipment. It paid for former Justice Gableman's travel and expenses associated to travel, and some of his staffers' travel, including one that lived in Arkansas and was traveling back and forth. It also paid for a lot of legal bills. There were a lot of lawsuits surrounding this probe, and a lot of the money that was spent, I think it's about, WisPolitics just reported it was about $1.3 million so far, that has gone to lawyers.
Are there other costs that might be associated with the probe that aren't included in this number? Do you think that there's additional costs yet to be discovered?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think there will be more legal bills than we know of at this point. You know, that amount could climb because of, you know, some of the stuff is still in court. So that's something that we're going to be looking for. And, you know, also just looking for what was actually reimbursed by taxpayers. A speaker's office did not want to reimburse him for some of the trips he made to these election conspiracy theory focused events. And in some cases they did reimburse him for that travel and then later said that they would get that back. That's something else I'm going to be looking for to see if they actually did get that money back.
Can you talk a little bit about that, how you as a journalist working on this story, how you go about pinpointing that number and finding out mm-hmm. where those tax dollars went?
Yeah, I mean, it's really all the public records law and, you know, making requests under the public records law for legal bills, for email communication regarding travel or reimbursements, asking the assembly officials for, you know, an accounting of all of that. And just, you know, continuing to ask about it. A lot of it is just continuing to ask about it.
Sure.
So just persistence too helps.
Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This is the State Capitol Report. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. And for Kate Archer Kent, you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, and for Kate Archer Kent, we continue our discussion on the Gableman investigation and what future election oversight could look like in Wisconsin. Join in with your questions about the probe and its findings. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, this month, Democrats in the legislature's Joint Audit Committee requested an audit of the Gableman investigation. The letter says the Office of Special Counsel appears to be one of the most, quote, blatant misappropriations of tax dollars in our state history. How likely is an audit, in your opinion?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. if the Republicans who control that committee have not acted on that request thus far, I think the chances that they will are pretty low. As we know, the Republicans control the legislature, and if Democrats are requesting something, that means they don't have, if just Democrats are requesting something, that means they don't have public Republican support for their effort, and that means that it probably won't happen. So my guess is that will not happen, but anything is possible. The Assembly Speaker, he really shifted his attitude toward the whole effort. You know, I mean, he was pretty supportive even when, you know, there was some reporting and testimony in court hearings that showed that he wasn't really, you know, Gableman hadn't done much work in the first few months of the probe, and he was getting paid for it. he still, you know, Assembly Speaker Voss still stood by him. And then after Gableman campaigned for Voss's primary challenger, Voss's attitude shifted completely. And that's when we heard what we heard at the top of this interview, the criticism of Gableman by Voss. So it's possible that that might trigger something, but it looks unlikely. There were some Republicans a few months ago who voted for a motion on the floor, a resolution. It might have been a resolution, I'm not sure, to request an audit. But that was, you know, something that was done that put Republicans on the spot because they were on the floor. And there were some Republicans who said that they would, you know, back that. So there is some Republican support in the legislature to do that. But if I haven't seen any action on that yet, it's unlikely. But anything is possible. I will say that.
Sure. I think you point out a good point here to consider that Robin Voss did change his tune about this over, mm-hmm. you know, over the course of the investigation. He changed his mind about what was going on. And even though it's unlikely, as you say, if an audit would be launched, what kinds of things would it seek? Would it look for broken laws or how money was used? What would it look for?
So that would be up to the Legislative Audit Committee. The committee would set the questions that the audit should be trying to answer. So it can range from, you know, something very broad to something very narrow. You know, the audit committee could ask the audit bureau just to look into, you know, how much office equipment, you know, the, mm-hmm. the former Supreme Court justice still has that belonged to taxpayers or something like that. Or it could, you know, answer the questions that you're talking about. You know, how much money was spent? Where did it go? What did he do every day? You know, were there any laws broken? What communication did he have? You know, I mean, so the audit bureau could look at a lot of things, but it's really up to the lawmakers on the committee to tell them what to look at.
Molly, I'm curious if you have a sense of whether Wisconsin Election Commission members are in favor of further investigating fraud in the 2020 election. What are you hearing?
Well, most of the conversations I hear from the Elections Commission members are about, defending the result that was publicized, you know, defending the election clerks, defending their work, defending the, you know, the outcome of the election, defending the certification of the election. Some of the Republican members have said that, you know, there is all of this mistrust of the outcome of the 2020 election. We should do something about that. You know, we should try to, you know, whether it's education or what, but for the most part, the Elections Commission has been at the center of a lot of these conspiracy theories and a lot of the accusations. And so they've kind of been on the defense, you know, for many months at this point. And generally what I hear is just, you know, trying to, defend the Elections Commission administrator, Megan Wolf. She was a big target of the Gableman probe. Gableman talked about her a lot, you know, and so that's what I hear from them. It's just a lot of, you know, wanting to maybe have more education or just, you know, defending the workers.
We're talking about the influence of Michael Gableman and the Office of Special Counsel. Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Some Wisconsin Republicans want to transfer election oversight from the State Elections Commission, which you just said has been kind of, you know, on the defensive. They want to transfer that to the Secretary of State. So we have Democrat Doug LaFollette, the current Secretary of State. In November, he's going to be facing Republican challenger State Representative Amy Loudenbeck. What have Republicans said about how the Secretary of State office would oversee elections if that were to take place?
So that's a tough question because not all Republicans agree on this. The legislative leaders, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu, they both do not want to do that. They want to keep the Elections Commission. This Election Commission was created just a handful of years ago by Republicans, and many of whom are still in office. And the Republican candidate for governor who could sign a bill that would do that has said that he wants to get rid of the Elections Commission, but create essentially a new elections board. He hasn't released any details about how that would work or who would be on it. He said he wants somebody from each congressional district and has suggested that members of Congress could appoint these elections commissioners or election board members, but he hasn't really released any details or answered questions about how that would work. So, but there are a lot of, you know, former candidates, Republican candidates for governor, you know, wanted to move these election duties to the Secretary of State's office. And then there's, you know, there's a push to have Republicans take over that office that has been held by Doug LaFollette, who's a Democrat, for decades. And it's important to know that this office has a tiny budget. Mm-hmm. It has a very small budget. I think there's maybe less than five staff positions allocated to this office. It's in the basement of the Capitol. Mm-hmm. It's very small. So if this were to happen, it would be a big effort to change what that office is. You know, they'd have to create a whole new budget and a whole new purpose for that office, because right now there's very few duties of that office. So while there was a lot of talk among people that could actually make it happen if they were to win in November about moving those duties to the Secretary of State, and it still could happen, you know, depending on the outcome of the November election. Right now, the Republicans who are poised to be either in place or, you know, who are up for election in November don't want to do that.
We have about 30 seconds left. What influence is the Office of Special Counsel and Michael Gableman's firing having on voters? What do you see?
I still hear a lot of the theories he put out there that didn't have any evidence, including, you know, there was too much nursing home voting turnout, that those conclusions reporters were able to find problems with. But, you know, as we know, like, there's a whole bunch of different information sources these days. And mm-hmm. So I hear from Republican voters that they believe that there was something wrong because of that data that
So there's still an impact. There's still an impact.
Yes. Yes.
Molly, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your perspective. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thank you. Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Just ahead, we learn more about the rise of fentanyl-laced drug overdoses in the state and what can be done to combat it with the Department of Health Services Director of Opioid Initiatives. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.